On the 26th of October 1932, a chosen elite of 50 writers were mysteriously invited to the Art Deco mansion of Russia's greatest living novelist, Maxim Gorky. The guests waited in excited anticipation until Stalin arrived with Molotov, Voroshilov, and Kaganovich. The party took literature so seriously that the magnates personally edited the work of prominent writers. After some small talk, Stalin stopped smiling and started to talk about the creation of a new literature. It was a momentous occasion. Stalin and Gorky were the two most famous men in Russia, their relationship a barometer of Soviet literature itself. Ever since the late 20s, Gorky had been so close to Stalin that they had holidayed together. Born Maxim Peshkov in 1868, he had used his own bitter, hence his nom de plume Gorky, experiences as an orphan street Arab who had survived vile abominations, living on scraps among outcasts in peasant villages, to write masterpieces that inspired the revolution. But in 1921, disillusioned with Lenin's dictatorship, he went into exile in a villa in Sorrento, Italy. Stalin put out feelers to lure him back. Meanwhile, Stalin had placed Soviet literature under the Russian Association of Proletarian Writers, the literary wing of Stalin's five-year plan for industry, which harassed and attacked any writers who did not depict the great turn with ecstatic enthusiasm. Gorky and Stalin began a complex pas de deux in which vanity, money, and power played their role in encouraging the writer to return. Gorky's experience of the savage backwardness of the peasantry made him support Stalin's war on the villages, but he found the standard of association literature to be dire. By 1930, Gorky's life was already oiled with generous gifts from the GPU, the secret police. In 1931, Gorky returned to become Stalin's literary ornament, granted a large allowance as well as the millions he made from his books. He lived in a mansion in Moscow, a large dacha outside the capital, and a palatial villa in the Crimea, along with numerous staff, all GPU agents. Gorky's houses became the headquarters of the intelligentsia, where he helped brilliant young writers like Isaac Babil and Vasily Grossman. The magnates embraced Gorky as their own literary celebrity, while the Czechist Yagoda took over the details of running Gorky's household, spending more and more time there himself. Stalin took his children to see Gorky, where they played with his grandchildren. Mikoyan brought his sons to play with Gorky's pet monkey. Voroshilov came for sing-songs. Gorky's daughter Marta played with Babel one day, Yagoda the next. It worked. During the Kulak liquidation, Gorky unleashed his hatred of the backward peasants in Pravda. "If the enemy does not surrender, he must be exterminated." He toured concentration camps and admired their re-educational value. He supported slave labor projects, such as the Belomor Canal, which he visited with Yagoda, whom he congratulated. "You rough fellows do not realize what great work you're doing." Yagoda, the dominant secret policeman, followed in Stalin's wake. "The first generation of young Czechists was distinguished by its sophisticated tastes and weakness for literature," wrote Nadezhda Mandelstam. "The Czechists were the avant-garde of the new people." The grand seigneur of this avant-garde was Yagoda, whose great achievement was the creation by slave labor of the vast economic empire of the Gulags. Addressing the assembled writers and playing ominously with a pearl-handled penknife, Stalin proposed, "The artist ought to show life truthfully, and if he shows our life truthfully, he cannot fail to show it moving to socialism. This is, and will be, socialist realism." In other words, the writers had to describe what life should be, a panegyric to the utopian future, not what life was. The writers, Stalin declared, were engineers of human souls. Literature mattered greatly to Stalin. Ever since the seminary, he had read voraciously, claiming a rate of 500 pages daily. In exile, when a fellow prisoner died, Stalin purloined his library and refused to share it with his outraged comrades. His hunger for literary knowledge was almost as driving as his Marxist faith and megalomania. One might say these were the ruling passions of his life. It would be no exaggeration to say that Stalin was the best-read ruler of Russia from Catherine the Great up to Vladimir Putin, even including Lenin, who was no mean intellectual himself, and had enjoyed the benefits of a nobleman's education. The Bolsheviks, who believed in the perfectibility of the new man, were avid autodidacts, Stalin being the most accomplished and diligent of all. He read seriously, making notes, learning quotations, like an omnipotent student, leaving his revealing marginalia in books varying from Anatole France to Vipper's History of Ancient Greece. He had a very good knowledge of antiquity and mythology, recalled Molotov. He could quote from the Bible, Chekhov, and the good soldier Spike, as well as Napoleon, Bismarck, and Talleyrand. He adored The Last of the Mohicans, amazing a young translator whom he greeted in faux red Indian, Big Chief greets Paleface. Stalin could certainly appreciate genius, but, as with love and family, his belief in Marxist progress was brutally paramount. He admired that great psychologist, Dostoevsky, but banned him because he was bad for young people. He recognized that Mandelstam, Pasternak, and Bulgakov were geniuses, but their work was suppressed. Yet he could tolerate whimsical maestros. Bulgakov and Pasternak were never arrested, but woe betide anyone, genius or hack, who insulted the person or policy of Stalin, for the two were synonymous. Stalin was not just supreme censor. He relished his role as imperial editor-in-chief, endlessly tinkering with other men's prose, loving nothing more than scribbling the expression that covers the pages of his library, that mirthless chuckle, ha, ha, ha.